contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
And I guess we start with some tears today, because it happened again. I know, I'm not playing Cheryl Wheeler's If It Were Up to Me. You can sing it to yourself, because you already know, first of all, it doesn't work. If it were up to me, I'd take away the fucking guns. Another shooting at an elementary school in Texas. Two dead, at least a dozen injured. That's all I know. There are no words. I don't know what is wrong. I do know what is wrong with us. Something seriously is wrong with us as a people. You know, there are days that you come here and we're silly and we have fun and we laugh and, you know, just have a good time. That's not today. Today is heavy on every front. I've got two guests on important topics, and I probably don't, I really don't think there's going to be a lot of laughter today. And then the news of the shooting happens. I'm beyond words. So let's start later on in the hour. There's a brand new book out. Chances are you've seen the authors of this book making the rounds, because it's kind of topical, timely. The book just released is called His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. And tomorrow is the second anniversary of his murder at the hands of Minneapolis police. So these two reporters for the Washington Post worked on this podcast really about George Floyd's life. And when the project was over, Robert Samuels and Tolu Olorunapia, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, still had some questions. And the result of that is this book. So we'll speak with Tolu a little later on in the hour. But first, I need to explain about our first guest. And in fact, I'm just going to bring him in because, Lev, I need to explain to you this as well, because I want no secrets here. So let's bring in Lev. Lev, I'm going to screw. So I'm sorry.
Hi. Go Lincoln, but it's a Lincoln. My name can be whatever you want it to be.
Lev, go Lincoln. Is with us. He writes for The Nation magazine, among other places. He's a journalist, an author. You actually were born in Ukraine and you came over here as a refugee when you were a child. Yes.
Yes. When I was 10 years old, I came to America as a refugee.
Wow. So now were you in Soviet Ukraine or free Ukraine?
Yes.
Soviet Ukraine. You know, I've got a good friend who actually was on with me. It was a few weeks ago now. Also a journalist named Larissa Alexandrovna. Are you familiar with her? Because she's also from Ukraine.
No, but it's a big country.
Yes, that I know. And it bigger, but it seems smaller the way things are going right now. So, Lev, the reason I invited you on the show is an article that you have up at The Nation, thenation.com. And it's about that disinformation governing board that Joe Biden had announced. And then it got killed, basically, because it came under so much attacks from mostly the American right. But then I found out a little bit more about your background and about your covering of the war in Ukraine. And so I need to say right off the top that on the subject of Ukraine, I think we have a slight disagreement, but that's okay. We can get there and we can disagree and still be okay. So yes. I'm glad you're here. Before we do anything else, let's talk about this disinformation governing board, because that was the original read. But I do want to talk to you about what's happening in Ukraine.
It was just a point. It was not canceled. It was paused. I think that's unfortunate, but it seems that they're going to be. It's not dead.
Okay, not dead yet, to quote Monty Python. But in fact, it's been reinvigorated. We were originally going to talk yesterday, and I'm kind of glad we didn't, because now there's a new development that this woman, Nina, what's her name, Jankowski or something?
Oh, Nina Jankowski.
Jankowski, yes. was ousted. She was the person who was hired to run this thing, and she's the one who came under a lot of attack. And I guess part of it is a you know, her own fault. I guess she likes musical theater or something, because you've seen these videos of her. They're kind of weird. Do we know why she recorded these videos?
No, but I think that's the least problematic part of her.
I think so, too.
I think it presents her as somebody who may be eccentric, but the problem with her is not that she's eccentric. And, I mean, I'm very, very grateful that The Nation let me run this article, because just talking about who heads a censorship board is kind of a bit like talking about like whether arsenic is best served with or without garnish.
Right. But hold on. I'll let you finish. But the thing that I have heard about this is this was ostensibly to target disinformation directed at the U.S. from outside the country. It's not like a thing to shut Tucker Carlson up, even though that would be hugely appreciated. That's not what this is. It was, I think, kind of legitimate. We've been the target of tons of disinformation on a global level. You don't think we should be combating that kind of propaganda aimed at us?
No. First of all, as somebody who came here from a dictatorship, I don't believe anybody should be combating disinformation on a government level. I think that disinformation should be combated by news organizations and civic groups. I don't think the government has any right to be inserting itself into it.
Wow. So like a Russian campaign that said that AIDS was manufactured to invented by the U.S. to infect Africans. That was a real thing that they floated, and the government shouldn't try to disavow anyone of that notion?
The government doesn't need a board to disavow anybody of this notion. The government can simply say. The government also, it's very dangerous considering how people have tied. Look at all the people who've been tied to Russian propaganda, for example, who've been smeared as being agents of the Kremlin.
And some of them probably have. Now, here's, I think, where you and I disagree. I believe that the Mueller investigation did find Russian interference in our election, or attempted Russian interference in our election and our way of life over here. Do you not believe that? Because I know...
Not at all.
Not at all. See, here's where we disagree.
I believe Donald Trump is a very much an American phenomenon. I think he was very much supported by American voters. And I think nothing of that has changed. I think... The election was fair. We didn't want it to be. We didn't want it to happen. I didn't vote for him. But I think that was just an excuse for a failure by the Democrats to win.
Wow. So you don't think that Russia tried to interfere in our or any other country's elections? It seems to me what I'm reading from you is that you're basically giving Russia a pass and calling everyone else out for their evil deeds.
No, as somebody who came here as a refugee from the Kremlin, allow me to assure you, I have not done that.
Okay.
I'm saying that Russia did not rig the 2016 election. That's not giving Russia a pass.
I'm not saying they rigged it, but you're saying they didn't even attempt to interfere.
They ran some Facebook ads. They ran some Facebook ads.
Okay. They ran some Facebook ads. Okay.
Yeah, they ran some Facebook
All right.
ads.
All right. So here's where we are. You don't think that the government has any role in preventing foreign actors from to quote George Bush, catapulting their propaganda to the U.S. and influencing how Americans think and deal with the world community. Government should have no part of that.
Absolutely not. There has never been in history a censorship campaign that didn't start in the name of protecting people. And that didn't end
up. How is that censorship? Who are they censoring? Somebody spreading propaganda from abroad, from other countries? That censorship?
Perfect example. Anybody who talked about the Hunter Biden laptop was smeared as pushing a Russian disinformation campaign as lies. And here we are, months and months after the election. The New York Times and a couple of other places said that, yeah, the campaign, the laptop was actually
They're saying that maybe it was. But even if it was, what does Hunter Biden have to do with anything? What is Hunter Biden? What does Hunter Biden have to do with anything?
Wow, we're really straying off field. But what does speaking about him have to do with being an agent of Russia?
You're the one who brought it up. You're saying, look, I think the whole witch hunt about this laptop, whether it was his or not, is irrelevant. It's not like Daddy put him in the White House and had him, you know, talking to foreign countries so that when they leave the White House, he can get $2 billion from the Saudis. Oh, wait, that was Jared. Excuse me. Yes. I don't know. It seems like, and I don't want to paint you with a broad brush. That's why I want to get your answers. It seems like you're fine with what the Trump cabal did, but Hunter Biden, oh my God, had a drug problem and did stupid things, stuff that his dad was not involved in, and that you want to hang your hat on?
Okay, first of all, you don't know me at all.
No, I don't know you at all.
About Hunter, I've written that Jared Kushner, that saying that Hunter Biden is not problematic is like saying that Ivanka Trump or Jared Kushner are not problematic.
How is he problematic? What did he do? What has he ever set foot in the White House? Does he have anything to do with this administration?
Oh, well, for example, he should not have been on the board of Burisma.
You're right. But that has nothing to do with this. That has nothing to do with how this government is run or anything like that. You're right. He shouldn't have been on the board of Burisma. We agree on that. Now what? So what?
Okay, let's pick a topic that you want to talk about. Do you want to talk about Hunter Biden? I can talk to you about Hunter Biden. Do you want to talk about whether I think it's wrong that the government should be in charge of attacking people who they think is spreading propaganda? I can tell you about that too. I mean,
but we kind of did that. And again, we disagree. I respectfully disagree. I think the government has a duty maybe to protect us against foreign disinformation. You don't think that's a problem. So if they want to flood our...
I think foreign disinformation is a problem. I don't think it should be combated by the government.
But you want to trust the media. So Fox, who calls themselves a news organization, you think they're capable to fight back against the propaganda?
As much as MSNBC or CNN.
All right. Hey, Lev, you know what? I don't think this is doing us any good. Let's talk about Russia. Let's talk about Russia, because you keep pushing the whole thing about someone keeps calling from the somewhere. You're backing up the Vladimir Putin's thing that they're going into Ukraine to denazify the country. This is what you believe?
Wait, excuse me?
You believe that Russia invaded Ukraine to, quote, denazify it?
No, where have I said that? Where have I even attempted at saying that?
You've been, everything I'm just reading from you, you're going on and on about the Nazis in Ukraine. Well, we've got them here too, you know.
Wait, that is two completely different things. You're telling me that saying that Ukraine has neo-Nazis is the same thing as backing Vladimir Putin's invasion?
Well, tell me, because it sounds, from what I've...
Invasion of my city that Russia is bombing?
Yeah, tell me about it.
Do you just mash things together, Nicole? I mean, you're telling me that saying that Ukraine has neo-Nazis is the same thing?
No, I'm not saying that, because I agree. There are some neo-Nazis in Ukraine.
You just said that I am. Yeah. What is it, backing Putin's assertion? Is that what you said I'm doing?
I just listened to an interview that you did with Halper. Katie Halper.
Go ahead. Quote.
I,
yes.
I don't have a direct quote. No. Okay. I listened to the interview, and all I heard from you over and over again was about the Nazi problem in Ukraine. You want to tell me about Ukraine. The Nazi problem?
Yeah, by all means. Ukraine is the world's only country that has a neo-Nazi armed formation in its armed forces, one that has committed war crimes as evidenced by the United Nations and Amnesty International, one that has been recruiting far-right and white supremacists from all over the globe, including four neo-Nazis from California that the FBI has arrested. None of that gives Vladimir Putin the justification, the excuse to commit war crimes to invade Ukraine. You see, those are two separate concepts that you can that you can keep in mind at the same time.
Okay, sounds good. And I get that. I'm with you there. There are Nazis there. There are Nazis here. Did you see them in Charlottesville? reason for anyone to invade us, right? And so we're...
As I have repeated numerous times.
Okay.
Russia is committing war crimes in Ukraine.
Yeah,
the fact that Ukraine has neo-Nazis does not even give them any justification to involve, to add, to go to an inch of Ukrainian territory.
Then we agree. We agree on that.
Yeah, and I don't appreciate anybody saying that I'm backing up Putin.
I just listened to an interview with you, and that's the impression I took away from it.
Well,
so you're here now. And I'm asking you so you can correct that. Now, are you saying that because there are Nazis, there are neo-Nazis in Ukraine, that somehow the government has that? Because as far as I know, the president is Jewish.
Yeah, the president is Jewish, and Ukraine has a neo-Nazi regiment in its armed forces. Both of those things are true.
Okay, and you think Zelensky is okay with this neo-Nazi regiment and his armed forces?
I don't know if Zelensky's okay or not. I know that the fact is Ukraine has a neo-Nazi regiment in its armed forces.
Okay, and we have a neo-Nazi problem in the Republican Party. So what are you going to do about that?
How many battalions is it?
I have no idea.
They try to storm
the U.S. Capitol.
Okay, and here we have a neo-Nazi battalion. Mm-hmm. That is has a track record of war crimes and recruits white supremacists from around the world. I happen to think that's a problem.
But what does that have to do with Russia bombing, committing war crimes all over Ukraine?
Nothing. I mean, this is... Are you doing this on purpose? I just told you it does not give Russia any justification to invade an inch of Ukrainian space. I mean, how can you not hold those two concepts in your mind at the same time?
I see it loud and clear. But again, you don't think Russia did anything wrong in terms of interfering in our elections. You don't think they're meddling in our government. I guess now you're saying it is a war crime, their invasion.
It's all connected.
You want to laugh at that?
Yeah, I want to laugh at the absurdity that you're saying that all of this. What is all connected? I mean, just ask a simple, straightforward question instead of saying that, instead of telling your audience that I believe something. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm asking what you believe. What do you believe Vladimir Putin is doing right now in relation to Ukraine?
He's committing a war crime by invading Ukraine.
Okay, we agree. We agree. Yeah. So what are you saying that the world should do?
I don't appreciate you saying that I'm supporting him or somehow backing him in doing that, but especially considering that it is my city that's getting bombed right now by Russia.
It's your city. Okay. What city is that?
Kharkiv.
Okay, Kharkiv. That's where you're from. Look, I have a friend who fled and now has gone back. I worry about the people there. I see the human toll. And I worry about the propaganda coming from Russia, where Vladimir Putin is saying, we need to denazify Ukraine. And then you point out, yeah, they have neo-Nazi brigades in their military. But you're saying that has nothing to do with this. That's not why Putin went in there.
No, that's an excuse Putin is doing.
Okay.
He doesn't give him the right to invade Ukraine, just like he doesn't give him a right to invade any other place because they have a neo-Nazi group.
But does it give him the right to catapult the propaganda to try to bomb people's minds rather than their bodies?
Okay, so you're saying we shouldn't talk about the neo-Nazis in Ukraine then because Putin is talking
about... That's not
what
I'm saying at all.
Putin also talks about racism. Russian propaganda loves talking about racism in America, loves talking about police shootings. They loved the George Floyd shooting. They were all over it. They loved it. They ran it so much because it plays into their part that America is irredeemably racist and evil. So per your logic, we shouldn't talk about George Floyd and we shouldn't talk about the racism in America because Russia uses it for their propaganda, which they do.
Lev, it's been real nice. You know, I was going to ask you about the one thing that you told me last night in an email. Back to the disinformation bureau, which was paused, not killed. It was paused, and now so they drove this woman out who has questionable musical theater tastes or whatever, a little weird, a little eccentric, perhaps.
And she also spread disinformation about Ukraine, which is what my Nation article was about.
What disinformation did she spread about Ukraine?
Oh, she covered up for the neo-Nazi battalions and said that they're nothing but volunteers, which is what the Nation.
Has anybody questioned her about this? This position, I guess, didn't need Senate confirmation. Did anybody, any reporter, anybody talk to her about that?
I wouldn't really know. I reported what she did. I have no idea who talked to her about it. I certainly didn't see any quotes from her on it besides what I reported on.
Okay, did you try to question her about it, or you just wrote that she spread disinformation about Ukraine?
No, I gave evidence in the article. Did you read the article?
I did read the article.
Yeah, I showed that in the video that she did, I showed what she said, and I said why it was wrong, and I provided proof for it.
But you didn't attempt to question her. You didn't attempt to get an answer to your question from her.
I didn't need to question her. I gave what she said. I provided what she publicly stated, and I said why it was publicly wrong.
Okay. All right. Based well, I like to ask people words. Questions, but I got it. But the thing that I wanted to bring up that you told me that kind of shocked me is they have reconstituted. They, being the Biden administration, are bringing this disinformation bureau back and making Michael Chertoff in charge of it. Michael Chertoff, the former Secretary of Homeland Security.
I have the press release. To help instill trust in our work, this is a press release. Secretary Mayorkas has asked former DHS Secretary Michael Chertoff and former U.S. Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick to lead a thorough review and assessment conducted through the blah, 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 blah. So this is now in their hands to be doing this.
In Michael Chertoff's hands, which is really, pardon my language, fucked up. Do we agree on that? Or you have no problem with Michael Chertoff?
No, I think it's horrible. And I think it goes along with the rehabilitation of people who are responsible for torture in America. I think it goes with, it's the same thing as John Yoo, who drafted the torture memos, getting to be a professor in a California law school, which I'm not exactly sure how that goes along with their mission statement. It goes along with the same thing as we made Gina Haspel run the CIA.
Which makes no sense either.
And to me, it's just a question of like, why? It's like, fine, let's put aside the Nicole and Lev disagreement. Let's say that this board is an important thing and should be constituted. Okay, fine. But can't you find somebody who doesn't have such a dark background to do this? Like, if you're going to be putting this board together, okay? And again, let's set everything apart. Let's just say we need to have a study to evaluate how it should be done. Can't you just find, like, why are you tainting it by bringing somebody with such a dark past, with the Patriot Act, with the blatant disrespect for law? Why not just get somebody else? You don't have anybody in America, millions and millions of people, you don't have somebody who doesn't have that background. It's contemptuous of just the entire process.
I agree. And for the Biden administration to put Michael Chertoff in that position, not only was he very much responsible for the Patriot Act, he also did the typical Republican thing. He personally enriched himself with those full body scanners that were put in every airport after 9/11. That was Michael Chertoff. That's his personal business.
Yeah, and having somebody like that, would you trust somebody like that having information with the disinformation board? How easy would it be to, for example, say, you know that rumor about the X-ray scanners? Nicole Sandler is spreading it and Lev Golinkin is spreading it. It was really started by Iran. So this is disinformation they're spreading. This is why it's so dangerous to have somebody like that. They couldn't just find somebody with a clean past. I mean, for ethical and for normal reasons to do so.
Well, the thing that bothers me more is the Republicans are the ones who fought back against Nina, what's her name? And frankly, I read your article. I have questions for her. I would like to understand what her cover-up is about, if that's what it is. I just think she's a strange woman. But Michael Chertoff, I believe, is evil. And the fact that this Democratic administration took this Republican DHS secretary and put him in this position because the Republicans derailed the first person they had picked, it just screams incompetence.
Yeah, and also, I'd love to know where, for example, the ACLU and Human Rights Watch are in this. And this is something I'm going to be, I'm hope to be following up with them, because they strenuously objected to him becoming DHS head a while ago.
Right.
So this is something that they should be jumping on. And this is something, again, it's important to find just something in common for people to agree with. Okay. And for whether you think the board should exist or not, which you and I disagree with, fine. I think it's important to say that for the good of America, somebody like Michael Chertoff should not be put in charge of that, or a hot dog stand for that matter.
This we fully agree on. And I think we need to start making noise. This came out of right field, and it's unacceptable. I could deal with the singing crazy woman. I can't deal with Michael Chertoff.
And it's just, and the whole thing about it is, I mean, look, it said that the disinformation board was attacked by disinformation, okay? Which, again, that shows incompetence. I mean, if you're saying that the fire department was conquered by a fire, then you know what? Maybe the fire department wasn't that good to begin with.
Right.
So it just, I mean, this is not something they need to, this is a, what is it called, unforced error, I guess?
Yes.
This is just something, this is not something, that they, and this is also something that progressives should have. This should be the easiest decision for a member of Congress who's progressive, for anybody who's anti the Iraq war, for anybody, just, it's not that difficult to just simply put out a press release saying, this is wrong. People who were involved in this, in the Patriot Act, in streamlining torture, should not be a part
Agreed.
Government.
So let's call the White House and tell them and ask them, what the fuck are you thinking?
You know what? I don't want to call the White House. I want to call the progressives in Congress, because they're the ones, this should be the easiest thing for them to say.
They had nothing to do with this. The progressives in Congress, what, you're going to call up Pramila Jayapal? She didn't do this.
But this should be an easy thing for them to just...
Mayorkas, the Secretary of Department of Homeland Security. Where's Mayorkas? Because this obviously was his choice with Biden's approval, I'm guessing. But it has nothing to do with Pramila Jayapal.
No, but I think that she's in a position as a member of Congress to start to hold them to accountability.
Okay.
I think the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, which raised issues about him before... should talk about it. I think progressive media, this is why we're on here, should talk about it too. Mm-hmm. I think generally this is something that should be an easy thing, okay? We don't have to agree on what happens. We can easily agree that Michael Chertoff should not be a part.
Absolutely. No. And on that note, that's a good place to part on. Lev Golinkin, I really appreciate your time. I appreciate that we can disagree, and we do on some things, and we agree on others.
And
thank
isn't
you.
Isn't that what makes America wonderful?
It is. It's one of the things. Lev, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. All right. Take care. Bye-bye. All right. So we are going to talk about George Floyd coming up. Wow. That was pretty uncomfortable, wasn't it? Wow. I want to share with you the song to see. This is the person that he was so outraged about because she was spreading disinformation. It's a bit too hyperbolic for me. But anyway, this is the ousted person who is allegedly going to be in charge of the Disinformation Bureau singing about disinformation. And I'm guessing she has a background in musical theater or something, because this is what the Republicans were all up in arms about.
Mongering is really quite ferocious. It's when a huckster takes some lies and makes them sound precocious by saying them in Congress or a mainstream outlet. So disinformation's origins are slightly less atrocious.
Okay.
It's how you hide a little, hide a little lie. It's how you hide a little, hide a little lie. It's how you hide a little, hide a little lie. When Rudy Giuliani shared that intel from Ukraine, or when TikTok influencers say COVID can cause pain, they're laundering disinfo when we really should take note and not support their lies with our wallet, voice, or vote. Oh, information laundering is really quite ferocious. It's when a huckster takes some lies and makes them sound precocious by saying them in Congress or a mainstream outlet. So disinformation's origin seems slightly less atrocious.
Okay, whew. She's weird.
That's now a law enforcement.
Okay, all right. No, but enough of him. So, yes, absolutely. Sorry, I didn't want to put him on the screen. Sorry about that. I thought it was humorous. And boy, he had knives out for that now former government official. That's why I had him on, is to talk about this. But then I read his piece. Frankly, I was going to have him on. I invited him on before I read the piece. So, all right. Enough of that, because I see our next guest has arrived in the green room. So I'm going to get the shot all set up and tell you a little bit about our guest. So tomorrow, we're doing away. The other topic is over. We're segueing now. And again, it's still not a fun topic. We're not going to laugh. We're not going to have fun today. But this is important that we talk about. Tomorrow marks 2 years since George Floyd was murdered. Murdered at the hands of Minneapolis police officers. And we saw it. We watched it play out in, not as it was happening, but we watched it happen. And it's, I remember the moment. I remember the moment we watched the video on this program 2 years ago. I had heard about it. And then, we pulled up the video. If we have time later, I'll bring up the set. Maybe we'll do it tomorrow. But regardless, it changed the events of that day, I believe, changed American history. It was a day that shook us to the core. We watched the video, and I had regular, Got a Laugh was my regular guest, and Amy Simon was on with us that day, and we were talking about it, and I said, let's pull up the video, and we did, and we sat here, probably in tears, in shocked silence. How does this happen? This should not be happening, but yet it happens all too often. And so that's where we were 2 years ago. So the Washington Post covered the story, I thought, very well in a number of different ways. One of those ways was with a podcast. And they did a whole thing about the life of George Floyd. And when it was over, two of the reporters who worked on the podcast said, we still have some questions. We're not done yet. And so they kept working. And that was Robert Samuels and Tolu. I practiced your name and I had it just right. Olorun Ipia. No.
Olorunipa.
Olorunipa. Because I spoke to someone else and it was out of my mind. Olorunipa. Tolu, thank you so much for joining us today. And congratulations on the book. It's called My Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. And did I set it up correctly? You started working on this podcast and you said we're not done yet?
Yes, that's right. And in addition to the podcast, we did a 6-part series in the Washington Post. The podcast won a Peabody Award. The series won a Polk Award. People were really willing to understand what we wanted to do, which was talk about the life of George Floyd, not just his death, but his life. And that's what we did with this book as well.
You know, and I'm glad you did this because, frankly, that in the immediate aftermath of his murder, and I do refer to it as murder because that's what it was and we saw it happen. The stories we heard about George Floyd, about that day even, we saw video, more video in the trial, other than the 9.5 minutes, but the video of earlier in the day, the video when the cops were trying to get him into the back seat. And, you know, I remember going through it, and the point I was trying to make was the man was not an angel. Obviously, he had issues. He had issues that day. They weren't death penalty offenses. He didn't deserve to lose his life because of it. But he was a bit, now I look back and I hate that I said it, but I said he's kind of a whining little bitch because he was. He's like, I can't go in there. I got it. Everything was an ordeal. And maybe when things are escalated to that point, everything is an ordeal. And so, but the fact is that he was human, he had flaws, but he didn't deserve to die. And I guess that was at the crux of this, and it's something that happens all too often.
Yes, and over the course of his life, just like you mentioned, it wasn't a death penalty kind of, hindrance or thing that he did wrong that led to his death. Over the course of his life, every time he made a mistake, there was always a disproportionate, unforgiving result and consequence. He never got any grace over the course of his life. And we saw that in his death as well. Yes, he was not doing what he was supposed to be doing when the police officers wanted to handcuff him. Yes, he had substances within his system. Yes, he made mistakes even, you know, during those final moments when he was arrested. But the result, the consequence, the way that society, the way the police responded to those mistakes was with harshness, with, you know, brutal force, not sort of thinking, what can we do to ameliorate the situation? What can we do to make sure that this guy, you know, is okay? He may need treatment. He may need an ambulance. He may need some support. Instead, it was always, you know, responding to him with harshness, with violence, with force. We saw that from his earliest age. As soon as he made a mistake in his life, you know, the society was right there ready to pounce on him. And that's what we saw as we documented his life from a young age, from the housing projects where he lived, from the schools that were segregated and underfunded that he attended, from the criminal justice system that he ended up cycling through, and in the healthcare system where he struggled and was always trying to find, you know, support and health and healthcare. And it was so difficult for him because of who he was, because of how society treated him. And we thought it was important to shine a light on his life and how, you know, he was struggling to breathe for decades before he met the police officer.
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it. He was struggling to breathe for decades. And everything we heard on all the research you did, what you learned about George Floyd, is that he was a good guy. He had a big heart. People loved him. He was, yeah, he had problems, don't we all? But at heart, he was a good person who was put, he was the victim of a lot of bad circumstances, which is unfortunately the same fate of so many Black Americans.
Definitely. And on that video, one of the things that was so striking was he kept telling the officers, I'm not a bad guy. I'm right. not a bad guy. Why don't you believe me? I'm not that kind of guy. Because he knew the stereotype. He knew what looking the way he did meant in the eyes of those officers. He knew what having the record that he did meant, even though the officer didn't know about his record. He knew that there were certain stereotypes and certain things that he carried that he didn't feel was part of his personality. He was always trying to outrun some of the things that were stereotyped about him and some of the things that were part of his past. And it was important for us to document his personality because, yes, people saw those last 10 minutes where he screamed for his mother and he begged for yeah. his breath. But he was so much more than that. He was someone who was always looking to, you know, make a better situation out of the circumstances that he found himself in. And he was always saying, I love you to his friends and to people that were even strangers because he had his mother's heart. He cried out for his mother in those last moments. He was a mama's boy growing up and he had his mother's heart, which was a kind-hearted personality. And even when he made mistakes, he cried and agonized over those mistakes. He wasn't this hard-hearted person who was a hardened criminal the way, you know, people have painted him after they looked at his record.
You know,
but he was somebody that was always striving for a better future.
Right. And yes, he was painted as this hardened criminal, this bad guy. And then we got to meet his family, his brother, his daughter, his girlfriend. They were all good people. And therefore, then you realize the narrative, what the picture that they're painting of this man, this doesn't jive. This is not, he's being vilified by, you know, the powers that be who want to lessen, you know, what the police did or something. I don't know. They want to paint a more acceptable picture of the police killing an innocent man. I mean, that doesn't make sense. And so was this what you set out to do in the book? I mean, when you and Robert Samuels decided you were going to keep going on this story, did you have something in mind? Did you say, yes, we want to delve into who George Floyd is?
Well, we knew he was loved. We knew that he loved people. We knew that he was somebody who evicted a lot of emotions from strangers, but also from his family and from people who knew him and people who felt the grief of his loss. And we wanted to dig deep and find out what was behind that, behind the fact that he had impacted so many people in his community, even people who weren't related to him in Minneapolis and in Houston.
Right?
And we talked to more than 400 people as a part of this research. And so many of the people who knew George Floyd said that he was somebody who was different. He was somebody who was loved in his community. He was someone that even as people saw him stumble and make mistakes and fall into the trapdoors that were waiting for him in society, he was always having that optimistic spirit, always trying to lift other people up and always you know, optimistically facing those challenges that he faced and always looking for a way to make things better. He left his hometown of Houston for Minneapolis because he wanted to go to rehab. He wanted to get a fresh start. He wanted to provide for his daughter. And we talked to his family members and we learned about the proud family tradition that he had and that his family was a proud American family that had worked hard over generations. Unfortunately, their hard work had not been, you know, met with any kind of financial benefit. They worked hard and their hard work was preyed upon. And, you know, some of his ancestors actually had their land stolen away from them because they were Black and wealthy at the time. But despite that, they were a hardworking family. They were an American family. They were part of this country since its founding. And it's unfortunate that George Floyd came into the world poor and was behind from the very beginning and spent his whole life trying to catch up.
And the thing that's so sad is the story is not unique to George Floyd. This is the story that's written about, you know, about countless Black men who have the same, you know, it's like you're born with two strikes and I shouldn't do a sports analogy, but you know, this car, the deck stacked against you and he had to fight against that his whole life, trying to do better, you know, from behind. You talk about, I mean, Houston, I remember hearing the tributes to him, you know, around the time of his funeral. There was a memorial in Houston as well as in Minnesota. And that's when he realized the depth of the love for this man, that he obviously did a lot right. And what does this say about society that we should be surprised by that?
Yeah, George Floyd was someone that had an entire community behind him. He had a lot of stature in his community. He was someone who people looked up to in his community. There were videos that came out of him speaking to younger people, essentially trying to deter them from getting into a life of crime. He said, you know, I have my flaws. I have my history. I'm not perfect. I'm no better than anyone else. But what's happening now is too much. The violence, the killings, the shootings, it's too much. Put the guns away. We can't have parents trying to bury their children. That's not the way the natural order should be. And that's what he was about when he was alive. And a lot of people looked up to him for that. They knew that he had gone through some troubles. They knew he had run into the criminal justice system and the police had harassed him over the course of his life. But he still was optimistic. He was still telling people not to get into the world of crime and shootings because he knew that involved a lot of pain. He lost a lot of people in his life. We document in the book the fact that one of his role models when he was a teenager was killed right in front of him by gun violence. Oh, and that impacted his life. You know, seeing so many people die, seeing so much violence in his life, it impacted his life. But he never took that route of wanting to be this violent person. He was always someone that was trying to stop the violence and stop people from engaging in violence. And it's unfortunate that he lost his life due to violence from the police that killed him.
Yes. And in fact, I wrote down a quote from the book. It said he had always feared being attacked, assaulted, even shot by police.
That's exactly right. He was aware of the police killings that happened before he became a national hashtag. And he's told his friends, you know, I feel like the police are just waiting to kill somebody like me. You know, he knew he was big. He knew he was the kind of person that the police might be intimidated by, even though he didn't feel like an intimidating person. And he realized that he had been harassed by police all of his life. We documented in the book more than 20 times that he was arrested or detained. One of the arrests, you know, according to the arrest report, the police officer said, "We arrested him just because he looked like he wasn't going anywhere in particular. He happened to be in his own neighborhood." And they wrote down, you know, that's why we stopped him, because he looked like he was just meandering about. And we saw many times he was arrested, sometimes for little or nothing. And many of the officers that arrested him were later charged with crimes, falsifying arrests. And some of that is still ongoing cases that, you know, they arrested multiple people. And it turned out later that what they were doing was falsifying documents and falsifying evidence. And George Floyd got caught up in that and he ended up with a criminal record. And when you're somebody with a criminal record in a state like Texas, it's hard to get a job. It's hard for your family, and you find yourself in this cycle of darkness that he ended up leaving Texas to try to escape.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. And again, we met his daughter, who was, I guess she's now 8. I think she was 6 around the time that he was killed. And her words stuck with me. They always will. My daddy changed the world. And he did, didn't he? Things, maybe not enough, but Black Lives Matter grew out of this. And despite the propaganda fed to us from the right about Black Lives Matter protests, for the most part, they were very peaceful, very respectful. If people getting together to protest a true wrong in this nation, structural racism in this country, and there were a few isolated incidents, and of course that's what right-wing media blows out of proportion, but there was a sea change, I thought, in our attitudes. Do you feel that way?
Oh, definitely. And the coalition that came together was a coalition that became quite powerful, politically powerful, a coalition that, you know, President Biden has to thank for his election.
That's
you
right.
know, we saw Black voters coming together, but not only the Black activists that have always been part of these protests, but we started to see white voters and moderate suburban voters and even some Republicans come out and say, what happened to George Floyd wasn't right. I may not have wanted to support past protests, but this is one that I want to get behind. And we saw huge groups of people coming out to the streets, and you know that
at the height of COVID too, with you know masks and everything, because it was dangerous.
Yep. In the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of a presidential election, it was a mass outpouring of support for George Floyd. Now we've seen some of that disappear over the last 2 years, but something did change in that moment where we saw people coming together, and there was, you know, obviously an outcome of a presidential election, an outcome of some Senate races that were impacted by the George Floyd movement. And then we saw local level laws being changed, things like chokeholds being banned by police officers in a number of different local jurisdictions. We haven't seen the big federal legislation yet, but President Biden is getting ready to sign an executive order
tomorrow, right? He's going to announce something tomorrow on the second anniversary of George Floyd's death along these lines.
Exactly. Now, it's not the federal legislation that people were looking for, but it's something, and it shows that his death continues to have an impact on us as a society, and he continues to have a legacy that includes people being willing to acknowledge that structural racism does exist, that police accountability is something that needs to be part of the conversation. And some of these laws would never have changed. They would never have even been a discussion about them. A president would have never felt compelled to sign an executive order if not for his death. So that is part of his legacy. It's something that we're still living in real history, and there's the backlash that we're dealing with as well, but is a legacy that shows that, as you said, he changed the world.
Yeah. Change doesn't happen immediately. There's incremental change. These are little things, but there's also the downside. The backlash, the whole right-wing fight against critical race theory, something that is not taught in schools. And I promise you, all these idiots at the school board meetings screaming about CRT, if you were to corner any of them and ask them, what is critical race theory? They couldn't tell you, because it's nonsense, because this is not a thing. What they don't want is their white children being made to feel bad that this country had its roots in slavery. It's history. And so, you know, and now woke, they're turning into a dirty word. So it's like, yeah, we go so far, and then you pull me back again. This is the struggle, though, isn't it? This is going to always be one step up, two steps back, or hopefully two up, one back.
Yeah. In this book, we spoke to the Reverend Al Sharpton, and he talked about the Newton's law of civil rights, which is essentially for every action, there's going to be an opposite reaction. And we're seeing that. We're seeing the backlash in real time. And Robert and I are journalists. We think that we should uncover everything about history. There's no fact that should be too scary for any of us, because it's important for us to know our history and know the truth. But there are some politicians that think that the truth is scary. The truth is dangerous. The truth may make some people feel guilty. And that's not the point of our journalism. It's important for us to acknowledge our history as a country. There's no way that we can improve ourselves if we don't look at the past, if we don't look at where we've been as a country. So as journalists, it's important for us to include the history. There's a lot of history in this book. We show the 400 years of the Black experience in this country, and how despite all of the hardships that Black people have faced, Black people continue to believe in this country. They continue to believe in the ideals. People are going out to vote. People are nonviolently protesting. They believe in the Constitution. And that's what we saw in the aftermath of George Floyd's death. So while some people may want to ban a book like our book because it does deal with history, we think it is an optimistic book that talks about the country in its full understanding and the Black experience in its full experience, which happens to be an experience of perseverance over four centuries in America. And that's the level of perseverance that we're seeing in the aftermath of Floyd's death as well.
Yeah, we need to stop talking about banning books. We need to be reading books. And this is a book that needs to be read. His name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. I'm just a little bit into it, but it's compelling and it's beautifully written, and you guys did a great job. You know, Tolu, I would love to talk to you more. When I started the show at 5 o'clock, the news was that one teacher and one student were killed in a shooting in Texas. Well, I made the mistake of just opening up my browser, and now I see it's 14 students and a teacher were killed at an elementary school in a city 80 miles or so outside of San Antonio. These are the problems we have, and this is not going away, and our elected officials aren't doing anything about it. I thought when 20 children were killed at Sandy Hook Elementary that something would happen, and now we see the unthinkable happening again. 14 babies. It's an elementary school. We don't know who these 14 students are yet, but oh my God, what is wrong with this country? What are we doing?
It's an issue we have not solved. This doesn't happen anywhere else. The only place in the world that this happens is the United States of America. And, you know, I cover the last three presidents, Obama, Trump, Biden, they all dealt with mass shootings. And it's been something that's been happening. Our Congress has seen it happening. They've seen these lives being lost, children, people who are elderly, people in church, people in the grocery store, people that could be our neighbors, being shot down and gunned down. It happened just last weekend in Buffalo.
Yes,
it's happening again in Texas with elementary school students, racially motivated, non-racially motivated. This is happening over and over again, and it doesn't happen anywhere else. And we have to ask ourselves as a country, is this the kind of country that we want to have, where people just going about their business, going to school, going to the grocery store, have to fear that someone's going to come in and shoot them, that
right.
Everyone has to have security and has to have, you know, metal detectors? Is that the kind of country we want to create for ourselves? Several presidents have been dealing with this. Congresses have been, you know, allowing this to happen without taking any measurable steps to change it. And it does seem like unless we actually change something, we're going to get the same result over and over and over again.
It's just astounding. I'm in Florida. I live in Coral Springs, Florida. We are the next door. We're the sister city to Parkland. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, I pass by it every time I'm out in the car. That building is still standing, by the way, this is a problem. Why we don't address these problems. And then Attorney General Ken Paxton of Texas suggested that the solution to school shootings is arming teachers. And the idiot we have down here as a governor, DeSantis, is my new nickname for him. He said the next thing we're going to do is constitutional carry, because their answer is put a gun in every hand.
Yeah, I grew up in Florida. I worked at the Miami Herald for several years. I'm familiar with that Broward County area, and I know that, you know, people have called Florida the gunshine state because we already have very expansive gun laws and we already have, you know, a very high rate of gun ownership. So the fact that, you know, there are efforts across the country, especially in states governed by Republican governors, to put more guns in more hands and say that's the solution. You know, we've had more guns in more hands over the past 10 years, the last 15 years, and we've had more mass shootings. We haven't had less of them. And I can't, you know, opine on policy because I'm a journalist and, you know, that's not my role, but right. I can state facts. And we have had more guns in more hands over the last several years. And we have had more mass shootings, and we have had more shootings that are not making the headlines because they're happening in communities like the community that George Floyd grew up in.
Right.
And all of these shootings are leading to real consequences for people. There are people that are not going to be at the dinner table anymore, people who aren't going to be on the football teams anymore and the t-ball teams anymore because somebody decided to gun them down and take their lives. And we have to grapple with that as a country because it doesn't happen anywhere else. It's a choice that we've made to live this way and to have these things be a part of our society. And the solutions that have been put forward about arming teachers and arming more people, they haven't worked so far.
No.
And that's something that we have to we have to grapple with.
Right. And instead of, you know, scaring us, it's like, oh my God, they're teaching CRT. They're making our poor little snowflake children feel bad that this country was built on slavery. We have real problems. That's not one of them. Teach history. You learn from your mistakes, or you're supposed to anyway, as long as we're armed with knowledge and information and we know what came before. It's when you start trying to cover it up and you know, you put out the propaganda and don't tell what happened, that history can repeat itself. Those are the things we should be teaching our kids. And instead, they're putting out these, you know, these scare tactics. And we're just backwards. Everything is backwards. So this news is just really hitting me. 14 students and a teacher killed in a mass shooting at a school. This has got to end. Tolu, I'm sorry that this infiltrated our interview. The book is out. His name is George Floyd. Do read it. And thank you for doing this. I know there was one, you guys, you and your co-author, Robert Samuels, you mentioned the series that you did for The Washington Post, and you centered on that day, George Floyd's last day of life. Was there thing he could have done that maybe everything would have been different? Or there usually is.
Yeah. I mean, he may have not gone out of his house, because as soon as he left his house, he did become a target, and he was living in a body that police saw as threatening. Even the police said, we had to subdue him because he's a big guy. So he was always someone who was going to be targeted by police. And that was something that made life quite difficult for him, because he knew, living in the body that he did, that he attracted the kind of attention that he didn't want. So it was important for us to document his last day. It was a tragic set of events. He just wanted it to be a normal Memorial Day where he was going to go and have a barbecue with friends, but he never made it home that night.
That's just tragic. It is tragic. And I'm glad you're showing the world that this was a good man. This was a human being, a proud family man, a good guy, and he was murdered by the same people who are supposed to be protecting him. And we need to change the way we do things in this country, because it's simply unacceptable. Tolu Olorunipa.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was great to meet you, and I really appreciate you coming on the show and writing the book.
Yeah, it's great to be on your show. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. You take care. Bye-bye. I'm thrown. Can you tell? It's not to say that, you know, a shooting where one person dies isn't tragic and fucked up and just beyond the realm of normalcy. But 14 kids in a school? I just don't get, and we know nothing that except one teacher and 14 students have been killed. Why? So that people can have guns? For what purpose? What purpose does it serve? So you could go out and kill animals? Do you eat what you shoot? And open carry, Texas, you know, proudly is open carry. So you have a gun slung over your shoulders. Does that make you feel manly? I don't know. I don't know how we survive this. Frankly, many of us don't. I guess this is how we end the show today. I'm sorry. Life's not supposed to be like this. I just hate it.
Maybe it's the movies, maybe it's the books, maybe it's the bullets, maybe it's the real crooks, maybe it's the drugs, maybe it's the parents, maybe it's the colors everybody's wearing, maybe it's the president, maybe it's the last one, maybe it's the one before that, what he done, maybe it's the high schools, maybe it's the teachers, maybe it's the tattooed children in the bleachers, maybe it's the Bible, maybe it's the lack, maybe it's the music, maybe it's the crack, maybe it's the hairdos, maybe it's the TV, maybe it's the cigarettes, maybe it's the family, maybe it's the fast food, maybe it's the news, maybe it's divorce, abuse. Maybe it's the lawyers, maybe it's the prisons, maybe it's the senators, maybe it's the system, maybe it's the fathers, maybe it's the sons, maybe it's the sisters, maybe it's the moms, maybe it's the radio, maybe it's road rage, maybe El Nino, where you feed raised, maybe it's the army, maybe it's the liquor, maybe it's the papers, maybe the militia, maybe it's the athletes, maybe it's the ads, maybe it's the sports fans, maybe it's a fad, maybe it's the magazines, maybe it's the internet, maybe it's the lottery, maybe it's the immigrants, maybe it's taxes, big business, maybe it's the KKK and the skinheads, maybe it's the communists, maybe it's the Catholics, maybe it's the hippies, maybe it's the addicts, maybe it's the art, maybe it's the sex, maybe it's the homeless, maybe it's the banks, maybe it's the clear cut, maybe it's the ozone, maybe it's the chemicals, maybe it's the car phone, maybe it's the fertilizer, maybe it's the nose rings, maybe it's the ends, but I know one thing, if it were up to me, I'd take away the guns.
I'd take away the guns.
I'd take away the
Time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
If it's Tuesday, it's primary election day in Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, and Texas. This week, we're all watching Georgia, where there's a proxy battle between Trumpism and the rest of the Republican Party. Former Vice President Mike Pence has been supporting Governor Brian Kemp, the Republican incumbent. He appeared at an event on Monday going up directly against the former guy who's endorsed Kemp's primary opponent, former Republican Senator David Perdue. Trump recruited Perdue to run, and he sunk $2.5 million of his own campaign cash into Perdue's race. Trump even called in to Perdue's teletown hall on Monday night. Yeah, that should tell you something, because he didn't fly to Georgia to do it in person. He said that Perdue, quote, is the only candidate who can beat Stacey Abrams, because I don't believe Kemp can do it. He's got too many people in the Republican Party that will refuse to vote. Ugh. But even with those rousing words of encouragement, if that's what it was, Kemp leads Perdue by around 22 points. Perdue was asked by a reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution if he'd accept the results of the election, and he answered in the Trumpiest way possible, quote, depends on if there's fraud or not. Okay. Early voting has surged to record levels in that primary. More than 800,000 ballots were cast ahead of today's voting. Remember Brad Raffensperger? He's Georgia's Secretary of State, who actually followed the law when he was overseeing the 2020 elections and refused the former guy's many clumsy attempts to overturn it. As with Kemp, Trump has blasted Raffensperger for not doing his dirty work around the election and recruited a primary candidate to run against him, Republican Congressman Jody Heiss, who has also parroted lies and made up nonsense about the election. But unlike the Kemp-Perdue race, in this case, the limited polling is showing a very, very close matchup. And they could be headed for a June runoff if neither of them gets over 50% tonight. But wait, there's still more. Senator Raphael Warnock is defending the seat he just won. He is unopposed in the primary, but getting ready for the fall when it appears that Senator Warnock will run against former NFL pro and Trump-endorsed football player Herschel Walker, who's never held elected office. All three, Warnock, Herschel Walker, and Raffensperger, are all expected to easily win their nominations. Moving on to Alabama, the race is on to fill the seat of retiring Senator Richard Shelby. In this race, Trump backed Congressman Mo Brooks back in 2021 in a show of support. Brooks had spoken at Trump's rally on the Ellipse before the January 6th attack on the Capitol, but his numbers have been slipping in polls, and Donald Trump recently rescinded his endorsement and never re-endorsed in the race. Well, funny thing happened. After Trump pulled his endorsement, Brooks' poll numbers began surging. This one, too close to predict. Stay tuned. In Arkansas, in the Senate Republican primary, incumbent Senator John Boozman is facing a primary challenge from another football player. This time it's Jake Bickett, for whatever that's worth. And in Texas, it's the runoff from the election they held in March. The biggie here is in Texas's 28th district, where conservadem incumbent Henry Cuellar, the only remaining anti-choice member of the Democratic House caucus. And he's challenged by progressive Jessica Cisneros. And I think third time is the charm. President Biden is on his way home after a meeting with the other leaders of the Quad nations, Japan, India, and Australia, at an in-person summit in Tokyo, where they discussed the ongoing war in Ukraine and other pressing issues. According to a joint statement, the leaders talked about their responses to the humanitarian crisis in Ukraine and reiterated their, quote, strong resolve to maintain the peace and stability in the region. There's peace and stability in the region? Sorry. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials reported Russian aerial strikes in east-central Ukraine and heavy fighting in the eastern Donetsk region, where Russian forces are trying to advance. And now, new satellite images appear to show Russian ships stealing Ukrainian grain. President Zelensky has accused Russia of gradually stealing Ukrainian food products and trying to sell them. Oh, man. And finally, as if COVID surging again wasn't enough angst for you, the world is now seeing a global outbreak of monkeypox. There's one confirmed case of monkeypox and four suspected cases in the U.S. The confirmed case is a man in Massachusetts. The other four are suspected cases in men in New York, Florida, and Utah. The CDC saying that while anyone can get or spread monkeypox, a, quote, notable fraction of cases in this latest outbreak are happening among gay and bisexual men. As a result, the CDC decided to hold a news conference about the outbreak now because LGBTQ Pride Month usually kicks off around Memorial Day weekend, and officials want to make sure the community was well aware of the situation. One leading advisor to the World Health Organization described the unprecedented outbreak of monkeypox as a, quote, random event that might be explained by sexual transmission between men at two raves that were held in Spain and Belgium. If it's not one thing, it's another. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.